like to call the August 11th, 2008 Health Commission meeting to adjournment, or to life. We were going to be done really quickly tonight. My name is Pam Hetherington, and I'm sitting in for Chair Lynn Enns. I'd like to start our meeting by welcoming our newest two members, Jesse Arnold and Don Williams, to the commission. This will be their first meeting, so welcome.
Thank you.
Would you like a minute to talk about yourselves?
I'm a consumer. I'm a parent, grandparent, great-grandparent, and mostly interested in keeping children healthy so that they grow up into healthy adults.
Yes, my...
Hello. My name is Jesse Arnold. I live in Cambria. I'm a consumer representative. I have a degree in horticulture from Cal Poly. I do take seriously the bylaws, which say our role here is to make health care better for everyone in the county, so that's what I'll be advocating for. In particular, in my interview I said, and I still am interested in cancer prevention, so we'll talk about that a little more later on. So thank you very much.
Thank you and welcome. The next agenda item is approval of the minutes. I know I have some corrections. Does anybody else have corrections? Jesse?
Yes, on the minutes for the July meeting, or it's talking about the March 2009 meeting, I volunteered to invite Clint Slaughter to talk about cancer prevention. And I can tell you for this meeting that he has accepted the invitation. Now, I know Lynn Enns spoke of inviting the Cancer Society. I thought that she was going to take care of that, but she'll need to make that clear for us whether she's doing that or whether she wants me to invite the Cancer Society. But for sure, the minute should say that I volunteered to invite Dr. Clint Slaughter. Okay? Thanks.
Jesse, I'm going to leave it up to you to remind Chair Enns when she returns that she would be in charge of inviting the Cancer Society. So we have clear indication of who's doing what. Any other corrections? I have a correction on page 2, number 8, the Pesticide Use Task Force. I don't think we were intending to have the Farm Bureau at this meeting. I think it's more the Agricultural Commissioner's Office, the Regional Water Quality Control Board, and I think Janice Campbell is going to represent DPR with the community guide. I think it's lending itself more towards regulatory updates rather than other groups. So, and they've all RSVP'd, so that will be the agenda. If there's no more changes, I'll entertain a motion to approve as amended.
I so move.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any dissent? Thank you. Next, we'll go to public comment on any item not on the agenda. Please introduce yourself.
Good afternoon. My name is Patty Nolan. I live in California Valley. I'm here tonight to talk to you about Valley Fever. The photos I've handed Mr. Arnold are photos I've taken for the last 2 days in the morning. You'll note that that cloud bank, that dust bank, is about a mile long. That dust bank contains valley fever along with anthrax. That dust bank is caused by the commercial sheep grazing that my community service district is illegally contracting out in our valley. That is all private property you're looking at. They don't have anybody's permission to do it. And yet they're still doing it. Here's the get. In the last 30 days, I've had 5 people die in my community. That is an outrageous number in any community, let alone one that has 151 residents. Maybe 500 total out there. We're not sure. They come and go for the weekend. They come and go daily. But we know we have 181 voting residents in my valley. Five of them died in the last 30 days. They died of cancer, unknown causes, cancer, heart attack, and the last one is sick in Kern Medical Center with a morphine drip. She's expected to die also. So that would be six. They are all elderly, they all have compromised immune systems, and that is exactly what Valley Fever attacks. Nowhere else in this county does this kind of thing take place. This is a suburban residential zoned area. And as I said, that dust cloud is just one example in the last 2 days. These sheep are running unabated. They have no grazing rights out there. They're roaming at large. They absolutely denude the soil beyond belief, making sure that there's no ground cover for the ecosystem. No critters means no, you know, birds, no raptors, means no coyotes, no bobcats. It just keeps going. We have put so much money into that area preserving the kit fox habitat, and now we just let these guys roam 3,000 to 6,000 head of sheep out there every year from March to October. And that's when the health problems happen. Not any other time. I've lived with this all of my life. I grew up in Bakersfield. I grew up on Sharktooth Mountain. And never have I seen this kind of thing in a community be so ignored and so overlooked. And it's just wrong because it's an economic situation. The poor can't cry out. That's why I'm the only one here you'll probably see from California Valley. Thank you very much for your time. Yes, Mr. Warner. I've got 30 seconds, so.
Relax. Mm-hmm. We can ask you questions, and it's not on your time.
Okay.
Okay. I wanted to be clear. You say 3,000 to 6,000 sheep for what period of the year?
March through October. This is backed up by Art Trinidad and Tim Fielding of County Code Enforcement. They are unable to do anything because the CSD knows that this is a contractual issue, and they can get away with it, even though they're illegally trespassing, and basically it's a taking of private property. Nobody will touch them.
So obviously, you've complained to Mr. Trinidad.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
His words were, subpoena me in court.
Is there any fence?
No.
Anywhere out there that contains them?
Out. To add insult to injury, we are expected to fence them out of our properties.
Right, right.
This doesn't happen in any other county. Not Tulare, not Kern, not any other county.
There's nothing that keeps them out of the... This is private property,
mm-hmm.
as you said.
And there's also
there's
the
nothing
monument.
That keeps them out of the monument?
Oh, no, they've already cut the... They've grazed the monument at large. We've called John Earl, and finally I called Tim Field at the Bakersfield office, and they've just recently put up the long ceramic fence posts that say, specifically, no sheep herding, in three different languages. So that's the best they can do.
Okay, of the people who died, I heard you say cancer and heart disease. I know.
There's one unknown. We're not sure why
yeah.
he was taken away. We don't get those reports out
right.
there.
Right. But in other words, I realize that the Valley Fever is a concern, but
mm-hmm.
so far you haven't had any confirmed of this group of people. None of them are confirmed.
I have Valley Fever. I've talked to Dr. Einstein in Bakersfield.
Yeah.
When I moved to California Valley 3 years ago, all five of my dogs got Valley Fever within 1 month of living there. We lived in Paso Robles 6 years up until that point. My vet is going to testify in court to this fact. Almost everybody that lives out in California Valley suffers from some kind of link to Valley Fever. There's no way to get a test, unfortunately, because it's expensive. But a test would show if the virus is active in your system.
Wait a minute, it's a fungus.
Mm. It's a mycelium.
The epidemiologist who spoke here said it was a fungus, if I'm not mistaken. Anyway, we don't need to argue about that, but... thanks for coming in, and good luck.
One last note. I would like to say I have called the Air Pollution Control District.
Mm-hmm.
Ag is exempt, so
mm-hmm.
they have nothing to do with this. That's why they threw me to you. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Anybody else from the public that would like to speak? Ms. Nolan, have you notified the Public Health Department? I'm sure we can add that to our list of questions in November.
You're the only people addressing the issue personally. Thank you very much.
Okay. I don't see anybody else from the public coming forward, and it doesn't look like Dr. Vernacchia is here yet. So if everybody's in agreement, we'll have Mr. Freeman from SunCal. Welcome, Mr. Freeman. I understand you're the deputy CEO of SunCal Health.
I am. And it's very nice to be here, and thank you for inviting me and SunCal to come and give you a brief overview of what we're doing in San Luis Obispo County. It's our pleasure to be here, and we look forward to informing your commission and answering any questions your commission may have as to our operations. But let me first, I'll give you, we have a little slideshow. And talk about the organization in general and how it's been since, is just to back up, we began administering the Medi-Cal program in San Luis Obispo County on March 1st. And we've been doing it in Santa Barbara County for 25 years, and we recently expanded up here and partnered with San Luis Obispo County. And so we thought this would be a good opportunity to give a report card of how things have been going, as well as to give you some background as to the organization itself. Oops, this goes fast. How do you make it go backwards, Gene? Things touchy. There we go. We are what we are known as in state and federal laws. We are that SunCal Health is defined as a county organized health system. And basically, we're not a private company. We are a public entity, and we are governed by boards and commissions. Our particular board of directors is appointed jointly by the Santa Barbara County Board of Supervisors and the San Luis Obispo County. So we are governmental entities. We also cover basically everybody who's eligible for Medi-Cal in San Luis Obispo County. They are automatically inscribed into our program. So, and we cover the full continuum of care, basically from beginning of life to the end of life, in the sense that we have all physician care, hospital-based care, pharmacy, skilled nursing, the whole continuum. So we basically cover all populations for all services that are medically necessary. Even though we're a government entity, we do not act like one in the sense that we operate at full risk. We do not have a guarantee of perpetuity, so if we don't do our job well, we can go away. So we are, again, It's quite interesting to have a government entity that we get a contract from the state of California, and we have so much money, and we have to manage that money prudently, or else if we lose money, that's on us. I think the thing that's made our plan and some of our sister plans, or all of our sister plans, there are five of us in the state, successful, is that we think the central tenet of the COHS model is that there's local autonomy, administration, and accountability. And when it's autonomy, we have the ability to design the Medi-Cal program that best fits the needs of this community. And what makes sense in San Luis Obispo County may not make sense in San Diego County or in Sacramento County or what have you. So we have the flexibility to design, use the resources we have to design the program and operate the program in a way that makes the most sense for this area. When it's local administration, we think we have a manageable service area. We're from here, we're from the area, we understand how it works. And it's small enough so we can look at events or, you know, outliers to pick up on things. We're not the end of an 800 number in Sacramento or Washington, and we're in the community, and we develop relationships with the providers and with the members and with community-based organizations. So we think we can manage the service area quite nice because it's the right size. And the last tenet is accountability. We have boards and commissions. And we are accountable, and if we don't do our job right, as I said before, we can go away. So we're not just anything we can say, if we don't do it right this time, we'll do it right next time. There's always the incentive to do what we can as efficiently and as effectively as possible. I'm going to be very touchy with this. Okay. As a public entity, there are differences between us as a public entity in the commercial plan. Obviously, as a public entity, we're nonprofit as opposed to for-profit. But the state contract with the State Department of Healthcare Services is only our only real significant source of revenue. We have some minor revenue, but that's about 98% of it. Unlike a commercial plan, we cannot cost shift from any other line of business to subsidize the Medi-Cal population, nor do we have the economies of scale that a Blue Cross or a Health Net would have. So those are the things we do not have that commercial plans do. However, plans like ours exist specifically to serve the Medi-Cal and low-income populations. Therefore, they are only in there for our most important customer. They are not, they are our top drawer, and that's what we're here to serve, and they are, again, our reason for being here, so we take that responsibility very seriously, and we strive to give them the best service possible. Again, as a public entity, we do not have the inherent conflict of a for-profit HMO, which is the needs of the patient versus the needs of the shareholder. That's not an issue with us. And one of the strengths of the model over the years has been we can serve as a coordination and integration point for any publicly funded healthcare program. Because we have, there's one infrastructure that's set up, and it makes a lot of sense to, if you can not create a separate one for this over here or that over there. So we, in Santa Barbara County especially, given our longer tenure there, we've been utilized by the community to operate programs that may perhaps couldn't have been operated otherwise. So we do have the infrastructure to pursue new initiatives. And I talked a little bit about our organization specifically. As I mentioned before, we began operations in 1983. In fact, our 25th anniversary is a month and 4 days from now. So we're closing in on 25 years. And we began operations at Santa Barbara Regional Health Authority. We changed our name when we came up here as of January 1st to reflect our new service area. We cover about, that slide's a little wrong, it's about 85,000 people in both counties. It's about 60,000 in Santa Barbara and about 25 in San Luis Obispo. One of the things we're very proud of is even though we're a nonprofit, we've been rated consistently by the California Medical Association as one of the most effective or efficient health plans in the state. And we have about a 7% administrative load. So basically 92 cents out of every dollar goes to direct patient care. We've also received some quality awards from the state regarding the work we do in terms of ensuring our members get quality of care and they get their immunization, members get their immunizations, and if we identify diabetes, we treat it, and asthma, and so forth. And we do have established a number of disease management programs, which not only helps the program be effective and efficient, but it's also that's best for the patient. It teaches people with the diabetes to manage their diet, to get their exercise. And if they do that, they stay out of the hospital, and then it's good for everybody. And that's been very effective. We have some of the highest diabetes ratings in the nation in terms of the effectiveness of that program. And also, we're one of the leaders in immunizations with children. We have 85% immunization rate. This is briefly just the programs we cover. Go over it real quick. We cover Medi-Cal in both Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo counties. We cover the Healthy Families Program. That is for low-income children that don't qualify for Medi-Cal. We cover that in both counties. The Prenatal Plus 2 program we currently only cover in Santa Barbara. It's a very small program for low-income pregnant mothers and then their children for the first 2 years. Healthy Kids is yet another low-income program for children without health insurance, who wouldn't have it otherwise. And finally, in-home supportive services, we provide health coverage for the workers in Santa Barbara County, and we're looking at doing that here maybe at some point in the future. Our board of directors, as you can see, is appointed by both boards of supervisors from San Luis Obispo County. Besides Mr. Hamm, behind me we have Alan Iftanuik, who's the administrator of French Hospital, Dr. Renee Bravo, who's the Medical Society representative, Robert Nichols, who is a consumer representative, and then Supervisor Asajian sits on the board as well. And then, as you can see, the board, for the most part, is trying to be as balanced as possible. We have one hospital administrator from each county. We have one physician from each county. We have one supervisor from each county. The public health or the health services directors from each county are on it. So we're really trying to have the provider community balanced and equally represented in both counties. So all perspectives are accommodated. And if you have any questions at any time, please feel free to interrupt me. We have two offices. Our Santa Barbara office is down in Goleta near UCSB, and then we have an office a couple blocks over this way on Morrow Street, and we'd invite anybody to ever come by and say hello to us there, and we're close by. I want to talk a little bit about the transition going from the Medi-Cal into San Luis Obispo County and give you an idea of how well it's gone. One of the things that we use to measure this is the call volume that we get from our member services representatives. And we started on March 1st, so you can see at the beginning of the slide, we have our normal call volume, but then you see the big spike, and that is the first week of the program, because that's when, one, we're adding 25,000 members overnight, and two, most of those 25,000 members are going to have questions. And so you can see over the time that you're going to have an elevated call volume, but you can see it, the trend going downwards. And most of our what is this, how do I work this, who's my doctor, those types of questions have gone away as we're not only educating the membership, but they are educating themselves, and they're realizing that as far as their relationship with their current physician, nothing has really changed. And so you can see how from our data, the member perspective is that it's getting back down to a new equilibrium that accounts for the normal call volume for both counties. One of the parts of the transition that was a bit confusing was in the pharmacy. A lot of the pharmacists were confused as to who to bill for the pharmacy, us or the pharmaceuticals, us or the state. So after a time, we sent out a survey to see how well they thought it was going after we did some education. And you can see from the results of the survey, the pharmacists felt that it was going very smoothly. So the indicators that we have that we can tell shows that the transition has gone smoothly. We haven't had any mobs show up at our door or anything, and it seems to be very very quiet, which is good. Talk a little bit about our member services, and this is one of the things that we can offer San Luis Obispo, which was not available in the state fee-for-service system, is that we have a dedicated member services department that's only job is to assist members navigating the system and also act as their advocates when the need arises. They assist with physician appointments, educate them on how to use the system, help them find a specialist. They have a billing issue. They have a place to call. They're not just on their own. And we have our member service reps are very experienced in helping them navigate this. All of our reps are both bilingual and bicultural, so we do not have a language issue. We do have interpreter services available, both in person over the phone. We can basically interpret any language. If someone goes into emergency room and they need to speak, they speak Farsi or a doctor's office, we can accommodate that. So we can make sure there is communication. They have the ability to communicate. They don't have to rely on a child that speaks English and so forth. So we feel that's a big advantage. And again, we also track very closely any complaints or grievances members may have to see if it's anything that's systemic and is something that we as an organization can work on. Other things that we feel that help with the members is we have a health education program and a full-time health educator. Again, those are wellness issues, and so anti-smoking, obesity. In fact, we just hosted a few months ago an obesity summit here in San Luis Obispo, which is very well attended. Getting members involved in their own health care, reminding them when it's time to get their vaccinations. In fact, we send out reminder cards to parents when it's time for their child to get vaccinated. Please make an appointment with your physician to get your child vaccinated for this or what have you. We also have a comprehensive cultural and linguistic program. Again, that is to ensure that everything gets translated. It's checked for both accuracy and appropriateness. As you know, there are different dialects of Spanish and other languages, and there's medical terminology, so you want to make sure that is translated very accurately. So we do. We place a lot of importance on that. And again, our provider directory has they list what the physician language is. So you know when you sign up for a physician. If you need someone who speaks Spanish, you'll know when you sign up that they do, whether they do or don't. I'll touch briefly on disease management programs. Again, we've had very successful programs in diabetes, asthma, and high-risk pregnancy. And again, the idea is if you manage the disease, the outcomes are better. It's better for the member. It's better for the physician, and it's better for the plan. And they've been all been very successful. And we're also one of the founding participants in the State Medical Association's AWARE program, which promotes the appropriate use of antibiotics. It's basically encouraging physicians not to overprescribe the antibiotics, because that's what leads to resistant forms of viruses. Talk a little bit about provider services. What this slide is, this is the SoCal Health Provider Network. The first column is both counties combined, and the second which shows you what the San Luis Obispo county only would be. So for a population of 25,000, we have 325 physicians. All four hospitals are contracted. I believe every pharmacy is contracted, and all the skilled nursing facilities. And if you combine them with Santa Barbara, that is the provider network that's available to San Luis Obispo members. It is not, the county line's irrelevant. So if you look, the column on the left is the new provider network that's available for San Luis Obispo County Medi-Cal recipients. And also for tertiary care, we have contracts in place with both UCLA and Stanford and Lucile Packard for the children, because some physicians prefer to refer to Stanford, some prefer to go to UCLA, depending. Usually I think here it's much more Stanford, Lucile Packard, and down south it's more UCLA. But both are under contract, and so basically any service needed we can provide. One of the things that we've been able to do for providers, since the advantage of before March 1st, after March 1st, is we pay them more than state Medi-Cal, about 25% more. You may say 25% of nothing is not much more than nothing, but it's still better than they were getting. And actually, if you take into account what physician incentives and what the money they could earn by doing specific, achieving specific goals, their physician reimbursement closes in on the Medicare rate. So it's for a state-sponsored program. It's a very healthy rate. We've been able to, as the last slide shows, expand access to specialists. And again, the transition's been very smooth. And one of the things we do, which we think the providers like, is we pay them twice as often as the state does. So we find that very helpful. This is just a quick slide on how our dollars are spent. Most of the money goes through skilled nursing facilities and then inpatient hospital. But it just gives you just a snapshot of where the healthcare dollar goes. A lot of times when you think of Medi-Cal, you think of physicians and patients. And, sir?
I need help with these things where you're doing initials.
Sure. PCP is primary care physician capitation. So that's your primary care physician. Fee-for-service physician is a specialist. And then inpatient hospitals, obviously, inpatient hospital network. So it would be in one of the two counties. Inpatient hospital out of network would be UCLA, Stanford. Outpatient hospital is self-explanatory. The skilled SNF, ICF is skilled nursing facility, intermediate care facility. Other medical is usually allied healthcare, maybe chiropractors, acupuncturists, durable medical equipment. And then medical care management is staff support, and administrative is our administrative costs. But if you look at, well, most people think of Medi-Cal, they're thinking of doctors and patients. But physician claims amount to about 15% of the total Medi-Cal budget. Medi-Cal is so much more than physicians. Now, physicians drive the entire process. They're the ones who push the dominoes over. But 85% of the money is actually spent elsewhere. One of the things that we've been able to do since we've come up to San Luis Obispo County is, as you may have heard, that the state currently has no budget, which means that they are not paying their Medi-Cal claims. But since we're here, we are paying Medi-Cal. So San Luis Obispo County providers, physicians, and hospitals are being paid. And we'll be doing that as long as we can. So I thought I'd touch briefly on what's going on with Medi-Cal, the reduction. Basically, this, as you may have heard, the state's proposing, in general, a 10% cut to Medi-Cal. That's not across the board. Some are 10, others aren't. But we expect our own revenue to be decreased, probably not by 10%, but probably by 5 to 7%. We have to face the issue of, okay, what are we going to do if our revenue is reduced? How are we going to deal with that? And what do we do about provider reimbursement in both counties? Well, fortunately, we're fairly financial healthy right now, but we have about $43 million in reserve, and that that gives us about 30 million in excess of what we're required, regulations require us to have. So what our plan is, unless it changes because of the budget, our plan right now is to keep reimbursement levels the same. So there will be no cuts at this point to any provider in San Luis Obispo or Santa Barbara County for Medi-Cal. We won't give them any increases, but we're not going to do any cuts. And we would just basically spend down our reserves in order to do that. But that's the reason the reserves are there, is to you save money in the good times to use them in the bad times. Now, this is kind of a complicated graph, but basically what our plan is, we think we can hold out about 2 years by not cutting the revenue. And that purple line going down shows how that's our reserve level, how that dips with reduced revenue. So what our board of directors has decided is we're going to try and keep Medi-Cal rates as stable as long as we can. And so that is the plan. Now, once we get closer, if it, God forbid, it gets to the point where we're getting real close to that purple line hitting the bottom, we may have to do some other things. But that gives an idea of what our timeline is in terms of maintaining current payments to Medi-Cal providers. And that is it. Hopefully I didn't take too much of your time or bore you needlessly, but I'll be glad to answer any questions you would have.
Commissioner O'Dell?
Yeah, so the last slide you showed, is that your budget, $65 million or something?
Our total budget's about $250 million.
$250 million, okay. The other thing, you said you have 325 physicians signed up in San Luis Obispo County, was that?
Yes.
Now,
well, there was, yes, 325.
Does that include the community health clinics?
Yes.
You count the physicians in there, too?
Yes.
How many additional physicians have you signed up beyond the community health clinic?
Well, I think we have pretty much everybody. We have about 50 more physicians that were signed up for Medi-Cal prior to March 1st. And we think the difference is a lot of physicians were signed up for Medi-Cal prior to March 1st, but they weren't actually seeing patients. One of the things that encourages our physicians to actually see patients is we have this physician incentive program where they can earn quite a bit of additional dollars if they meet these goals and objectives, which are, in the most part, based on delivering care. So, as far as I know, we have more than adequate capacity, and there may be a few out there that have refused to contract or declined to, but for the most part, we have very robust participation from the physician
marvelous,
community.
Marvelous.
Commissioner Arnold?
There was one acronym, LTC, under your population near the beginning of the presentation. I didn't get...
Long-term care.
Okay.
So that's skilled nursing facilities and intermediate care. That's just the combined acronym of the two subgroups.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Is there anybody from the public that would like to ask questions?
Oh, we do have, like, annual reports and some other materials we can leave with Gene here if you're interested.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman.
All right, thank you very much.
Dr. Vernacchia, you weren't here, so I bumped you. So you're on next.
Thank you very much. Do I have a speaker or microphone or anything, or just talk? I'm on, okay. I'm here on behalf of the San Luis Obispo County Medical Association to answer a few of the questions and give you a little update of what Dr. Christensen presented last year. I'm the treasurer of the society or the association, and we discussed the issues at our last meeting on Thursday, and I'm going to try to answer your questions as per the email from last week. So I'll start first with the first question was, has access to primary physician and specialty care improved? And are we still short primary care physicians for the size of its population? Well, we're still short. Okay, the last estimate by a consultant by Sierra Vista was that we're about 48 primary care physicians short. We are getting some in, but as you try to accommodate for the number of retirements and defections to the state-run organizations, it's a little difficult to keep up. The prison system has been an incredible drain on the primary care resources in our community. I know of at least 3-4 primary care physicians that have left the private sector to go to work for CMC in the last year, and you can't blame them. I mean, the pay is just so much greater than what you can do in private practice, and that doesn't include the retirement benefits that you get from them also. So in answer to your question, has it improved? The answer is no. Okay, it has not improved. With regard to specialty care, it also has not improved. We've been able to recruit some specialists. We've gotten actually 2 new neurologists have come to town and are servicing between Santa Maria and San Luis Obispo. We've gained a couple of cardiologists by Sierra Vista. They've recruited a couple there. The big problem, though, is that although we've recruited them, we're still having trouble with emergency room coverage. And what do I mean by that? And we'll get into what the statistics are showing in the emergency room. We've seen about a 4% increase in population in San Luis Obispo, in San Luis County, from 2000 to 2007. ER visits have gone up 29%. And these, believe it or not, they're not just indigent. They're not just from the Medi-Cal and CenCal population, but they're people with Blue Cross and Blue Shield and United Healthcare and Cigna and everything else. So that's kind of gives you somewhat of an idea of what's happening with primary care access. It hasn't improved, and it's showing up in the emergency room. Certainly not the most efficient way to deliver care. What are the challenges of the emergency room physicians? And the challenges of the emergency room physicians are that in terms of coverage, they do not have specialty coverage for all of the major specialties each and every night of the week. For instance, there is no cardiology coverage in Twin Cities. They might have coverage 1 week a month, if that, and that creates a real problem for retaining emergency room physicians, because part of the problem for the emergency room physicians is they're not only having to face the immediate care, but then they don't have a shoulder to lean on when the care goes above and beyond their level of expertise. So that creates a problem for retaining those physicians. It becomes a little uncomfortable. With regard to retaining physicians in our county, we're still faced with a cost of living problem. The cost of living here has outstripped the payments to physicians, and I brought my favorite chart, and I don't know where the camera can show it, but I guess I'll hold it up toward that camera, and maybe they can shoot on it, and I'll show it to the audience. I don't know if they can project it up there. Oh, good. Perfect. Facing is that Medicare keeps dropping our payments every year. We were scheduled to have about a 15% pay cut because it keeps piling up. And what's happened is you can see since about the year, what is that, about? Let me look over here.
2001.
What's happened since 2001 is that what's called the SGR was adjusted in 1997. The SGR stands for the Sustainable Growth Ratio. And what the federal government said is that in order for us to continue to pay for Medicare, We have to come up with a way to essentially balance the budget and make sure we have enough money to continue to pay for Medicare. So what they did was they tied their formula to the gross domestic product. Okay? Now, remember, if they tie how much they're paying from 2000 on to the gross domestic product, that means that's how much they will pay to the program. Okay? That does not mean that as the number of enrollees goes up, we increase the payment as a factor of the number of enrollees. We just increase the total pie that goes to Medicare by that amount. As a result, if you look at what was going to happen to physician payments per procedure, we were basically scheduled to get, you know, anywhere from 2 to 5% pay cuts each year. So if you take a look at the chart up there, you'll see that in 2001, we got hit with about a 5% pay decrease, okay? Well, you can imagine how well that goes over when your costs, which are the practice costs, go up by 3 to 5% per year. So if you look at what happened between 2001 and 2007, what happened was the federal government tortured us with 0.5% and 1% increases. But remember, each time we get a 1% increase, we're losing 2 to 3% per year. So as you stretch out that graph, as we stay even and our practice costs go up, well, you can see that since 2000, we've basically treaded water because we absorbed the 5% decrease and were tortured with 1 to 0.5% increases until 2007. In the meantime, our practice costs kept going up during those 7 years at 2 to 3%. So now we're behind by 20%. So then you wonder how easy it is to retain physicians. Recognize that your typical primary care physician, their overhead in their practice is about 60%. Okay, that means that if they bring in $100, okay, 40% of it goes to them, 60% goes to cover costs. Okay, well, now, as your overall $100 goes up by 101, but your 60% costs keep going up by 2 to 3%, you can see that the balance between what you actually take home and what your costs are just keep getting more and more disproportionate, meaning that your 60% overhead keeps going up relative to your total dollar amount. It's pretty simple to understand. So you can understand how as that continues to go on. Now, you can see 2007, this chart is 1 year old. So you can see that we were scheduled to get a 10% cut in 2007. But Congress marched in on their white horses, and on December 31st, they said, we won't cut you the 10%, but we're going to fix it in July. So we're going to give you a 0.5% increase on January 1st, and come July 1st, we'll fix the whole problem. Well, they've been saying that for years. Come July 1st, they still hadn't fixed it, and they couldn't get anything past Congress because of the partisan issues that we have. And finally, what they did was they passed a 1% increase, and they said, well, we can't seem to fix it in 6 months, so what we're going to do is give you a 1% raise for the next 18 months. So we won't face it again on December 31st, okay? But rather, we'll wait until December 31st of 2009 when we still won't have it fixed, and then we'll face it then. They finally did give us the 1% raise, but let's face it, look at your chart. As you grab a 1% raise, that gets us maybe above the 0% line, and our practice costs keep going up. So how does it get to retaining physicians? Well, it's pretty obvious what happens. Now, recognize that all third-party payers, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, everybody follows these payment fee schedules. So when we're not getting any kind of raise, it's across the board. Whatever Medicare does, everybody follows. So Any questions on this before I march down to the other questions that we have? Okay. The other challenges we spoke of last year were education. California does not produce enough physicians. The reality is that we actually are not doing a bad job producing physicians. The problem we're having is all of our tax dollars are going to produce the physicians who come out of practice, out of training, and say, I can't afford to be in here, not with Region 99 payments, which is what we have in San Luis Obispo. And with those payments, recognize that the cost of living in a county like San Luis Obispo or Santa Barbara, it's the same as it is in Marin County or Santa Clara. But there's no incentive in the Medicare system to fix that problem because there's a higher population in those counties, and they, as a result, there's more votes. Well, with more votes, it's like, well, how are you going to take money away from the people with all the votes and give it to the people without the votes who need the money to provide the health care to their constituents? So we don't have a problem training them. We have a problem keeping them. Okay, they just get trained. All of your tax dollars go to train them, and then they leave. Second question was reimbursement rates. Well, I've been talking about that quite a bit with what Medicare has done. And the biggest problem, of course, is the formula, which is called the sustainable growth ratio. They just can't come to grips with fixing it because the problem is, where's the money going to come from? And the 1.5% or 1% raise that we got was essentially, it was a battle in Congress because it had to come away from the Medicare Advantage plans. And let me explain what the Medicare Advantage plans are. These are the payments that Medicare was making to the insurance companies, private insurance companies, that were providing HMO coverage, Health Maintenance Organization coverage. Okay, I'm going to stay away from all the initials. So they provided the coverage at about a 12% premium to fee-for-service. There were a lot of eyes that rolled in that legislation, but President Bush refused to back off. He finally got outvoted, and they took the 1.5% raise that we got actually came from the health insurance companies that were being paid 12% more on the HMO plan for taking care of Medicare patients than the fee-for-service people were getting. Okay. Now, mind you, the purpose of the HMO plans was to be able to pay less and get more. Well, it was just the opposite of what was going on. So that brings to the last question, which was, what's happened to the medical loss ratio or the medical cost ratio? Let me explain to you what that means. The medical cost ratio or medical loss ratio means that if you're a health insurance company, the first thing that Wall Street looks at, if you're a private insurer, is what's your medical loss ratio. That means how of $100 that comes in the door in premium dollars, how much do you actually spend on care to the patient? Okay, because the last thing Wall Street wants to see is that you're actually spending money taking care of patients. Okay, because the more money you spend taking care of patients, the less money there's left over to pay executive salaries and to pay for profits. Okay, so the problem that we run into is, although we have laws in the state of California that require insurance companies to have at least or a minimum of an 80% medical loss ratio, we still have companies like Blue Cross who go over that line, and they do it under the pretense that medical loss ratio, it does not include administrative expense. Okay, what they do is they fatten salaries. Okay, and admit that they don't consider administrative expenses. So what happens is the medical loss ratio is actually very low with Blue Cross, dropping around 76% to 78%, meaning that the rest of it is not going to provide care for the people that are paying the premium, but rather to provide bottom-line profits. Since Blue Cross provides for themselves a bottom-line profit of $10 million per day, day in and day out, that's correct. So between tonight and tomorrow night, they will have made a check to themselves for $10 million. It's very difficult to get the California Department of Managed Care and the California and the California Department of Insurance to enforce the rules that they have when $10 million a day buys a lot of lobbyists, okay? And that's the difficulty we face, okay, is how do you get the money away from the profits when it's those profits that are buying the votes? So how do you fix the problem? Find out whether or not your legislator is taking money from Blue Cross or Blue Shield. If they are, you got to ask them why, all right? I don't believe any of the people in our county are, but find out. Where do we go from here? I wish I had the answer. I don't have the answer, but I can tell you that one place you have to start is you got to get rid of for-profit corporations in healthcare. It's as simple as that. And until we get to that point and we can somehow manage to keep that money from buying more and more lobbyists, it's going to be very difficult to change the system. And on that happy note, I'll be more than glad to take any questions on physician supply in our county and what we can do about it.
Commissioner Arnold.
Okay, I think you've answered my question, but just to confirm, has the County Medical Association taken an official stand that they're for a single-payer system?
No, we have not.
Okay.
Okay. Remember, there's a difference between single-payer system and universal care. I think most of us are interested in universal care. The problem we've had with the single-payer system is Medicare's single-payer system, okay? Whenever anybody asks me personally, not the medical association, but me personally, what do I think of a single-payer system? My response is very straightforward. I'm all in favor of a single-payer system as long as they allow us to have a single-provider system, okay? Because what Medicare has done and what Blue Cross has done is we have no negotiating power whatsoever with Blue Cross or Medicare, all right? Two doctors cannot band together and say, hey, you know, I think we should get together and say, we're going to stop taking Blue Cross tomorrow. We can't do that, all right? Whereas Blue Cross, what's happened in the state of California is 15 years ago, there were probably about 75 insurance companies in the state of California. There are now 5 insurance companies in the state of California that control 80% of the commercial product out there. And although I have no proof of this, but if you look at what's happened in the counties throughout California, we have, in San Luis Obispo County, over 60% of the commercial market. No, it's 35 of the remaining 60. So it's about 60%, okay, of the commercial market is controlled by one health insurance company, and that's Blue Cross. Now, back in the day where you had, and then if you go to other counties, you'll find in Marin County, it may be totally controlled by United Healthcare. Or if you go to LA, it may be totally controlled by Health Net. So what's happened is the insurers have placed the doctors in a position where we can't say no to any health plan because that major health plan that we have consists of such a large part of our practice. So if Blue Cross comes back with a contract that says we're going to pay you now 80% of Medicare and we say no to that, we lose 60% of our commercial business. And what happens there is as they ratchet down the payments to each doctor, they can then lower their premium more, which makes their health plan more attractive to the buyers of the plan of the plans, which means that Blue Cross or Blue Shield that has not ratcheted down their rates can't offer as good a premium to the provider. So it's a cycle that goes on deeper and deeper where one insurance company gets a greater and greater market share in any particular county. And that's the problem we're facing.
Thank you. I know of a couple of physicians groups who have banded together and have indeed chosen to not accept Blue Cross products.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the status of those groups today, but I know there have been physician groups that have been successful in doing that.
There have been, to a limited extent, some groups that have gotten big enough to be able to, and it's limited to specialty too. Okay, it depends on what particular specialty, and can you get enough of a market share in that particular specialty, or get together a large enough group to where you can actually go to Blue Cross and say, well, guess what? You're going to lose your cardiology coverage if we say no to you. But that's the minority, okay? I wish I could say it was true for all of the specialties, but it's very difficult to do countywide. Yeah, but there are pockets that have been successful. Yeah.
Any other questions? Commissioner O'Dell, and then we'll go to Commissioner Guarino.
Yeah, you... In the bill that was passed and then Bush vetoed it and when it passed, I saw a reference of we're going to make adjustments in rural areas. Do you know anything about that?
Well, what happened was you're talking about the CHAMP bill, which was the Children's Health and Medicare Protection Act. Okay, what they wanted to do was take the SCHIP money, which stands for the State Children's Health Insurance plan, their program, and they were going to combine that and basically try to begin to redistribute the money, and I say begin to try to redistribute it, to the more rural plan, well, to those counties that had a rural designation but really weren't rural.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
okay?
Yeah.
But that failed because in order to do that, it was going to require taking the money away from the Medicare Advantage plans, which Bush was going to say, you're not going to take that money from the profits of those plans. So although if there is hope at chipping away at this problem if we have the proper political makeup come next November.
Yeah, just a quick story. I was on the board of Blue Cross of Southern California for many years ago. And as you know, it started out by hospitals, founded Blue Cross. And at that time, their goal when they were nonprofit was 90% or higher was the law. And of course, they went profit and boom.
Yeah.
Everything went the other way.
A little history of Blue Cross. When Blue Cross went private in the mid 90s, you know, they have to, if you're a nonprofit, you have to pay back to society what you took from society. They proposed a $50 million payment that's really what we took. CMA said, this is crazy. If you look historically, it was $10 billion was more like it. They ended up putting in, you know, $3 billion in the California Health Foundation, California Healthcare Foundation. But what's interesting is, think about what happened when they went from providing 90% of the dollars to healthcare to now providing about 76%. Man, it's just astronomical profits. Yeah, it's shocking.
Commissioner Green.
Hi, a couple of tracks of questions. One of them has to do with, you're talking about a 29% increase in the ER visits that we've had. So there's a lot of, we all know our ERs are really busy. And that ER coverage of the specialties is a problem. Do you have an opinion on what a one designated trauma center will do to the other hospitals' availability of coverage for those specialties? Will it hurt it? Will it hurt us? Or,
you know, I think, you know, we've discussed the trauma situation at the association meetings. What we're trying to do is create a plan that you have to go from a plan to a system to a designation. And what we as the medical association want to start with is a plan. And the problem that we have right now is that if you're in an ambulance and you are required by the laws to be taken to the closest hospital, okay? What we're trying to do is recognize that in order for us to provide the best health care for our community, that really isn't the best way, okay? Taking someone who's got tremendous head trauma and has, you know, had a recreational vehicle roll over their head in the dunes in Pismo, taking them to Arroyo Grande Hospital is not the smartest thing in the world, okay? But by law, they have to go there. What we're trying to do, or if you've got somebody in that's having a heart attack on the beach, do you really want to take them to Arroyo Grande Hospital? That's really not the smartest thing to do. What we would like to do as a medical association is to guide the county to developing a plan first, okay? And once we have a plan, then implement a system. And a lot of that plan has to do with what is the most efficient way and what is the best way to provide the best emergency coverage to our patients. I think down the road, we may end up with a designation, but I think we don't really want to get to a designation until we look at what's in the best interest of the patients of the county. And just jumping to a designation is not the answer. We want to say what we have around works quite well. Okay, I mean, we don't have designations, but despite the lack of designations, those patients with major trauma eventually work their way to the right place. What we'd like to do is to get them to work their way to the right place the first time and work their way to the right place more efficiently than what we're currently doing.
How close are we to a plan?
We've got a lot of collaboration going on, and the Medical Association works as a vehicle for that between the groups of physicians that run the two emergency rooms. So, you know, the good news is that there's a wonderful spirit of cooperation among the physicians in the community. I'll leave it that way. We have one interest, and that is, you know, we kind of feel that we're the neutral facilitator, and our goal is really to protect you people, and because that's really what we're in medicine for.
I have one more if I could. I think we're seeing a lot of physicians leaving Medicare, not accepting new Medicare patients, maybe not accepting new Medi-Cal patients, and there's been I'm not sure how large, but a move towards concierge physician services. I'm not sure how big it is in this county. I know there's some. Do you see a trend, or does the society see a trend in this, moving away from Medicare, Medi-Cal, and really private pay, and just going into the which could lead to a two-tier system?
It is getting closer and closer to that. I think that you're seeing a lot more physicians willing to finally say no to Blue Cross and Blue Shield and basically saying, you come in for your visit, this is what it costs you, pull out your credit card, here's the slips of paper you need to bill your insurance company, and go do it. And it may not necessarily be concierge practices, but rather physicians saying, I don't contract with Blue Cross, you take my bill or my super bill, you bill Blue Cross, I'm staying out of it because it costs me 10 or 15% to collect your money, and this way I can charge you a reasonable sum of money, you do the billing and collecting for yourself, and therefore they eliminate, you know, 10 or 15% of your expenses is a lot.
How pervasive is that? Do you think, percentage-wise, can you give a guess?
It's a small percentage. Well, it's a small percentage of concierge practices, but the number of doctors that are saying, I won't bill Blue Cross or Blue Shield anymore, that's continuing to rise. It's still a small percentage. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Commissioner Williams?
Do we have a gerontologist in this county?
To my knowledge, the last gerontologist we had was Dr. Cronin from down in Pismo. There may be, you know, I've got to check his specialty, but recently Dr. Tallier has moved from Bakersfield here and does a tremendous amount of gerontology and, directed, you know, quarterback care for relatively sick older people. So, but I'm not sure if he's got an official gerontology training or if he's evolved into that from internal medicine. But I'll find out for you.
Commissioner Arnold?
Thank you. I wanted to thank you for coming out tonight. And you weren't here earlier to know that I'm a new member on the commission, so I have a lot to learn. So I wanted to find out again, though, did you say you would like to see the for-profit insurance companies disappear?
Well, I think that they're a real problem. I mean, if you look at the fact that they spit out $10 million a day in profit and they use that to continue to ratchet down payments to doctors and to basically limit access care. I mean, the Medical Association and CMA knows that the insurers really add no benefit to the system, okay? They take from the system, but they really don't add a lot to it. Whether they're for-profit or non-profit, the insurers really don't do it. The non-profits, though, keep their medical loss ratio high, meaning that they're putting a higher proportion of their premium dollar into healthcare. For instance, Blue Cross puts about 76 to 78% of their dollars go to healthcare. Kaiser puts about 92% to healthcare. And you know, the other thing to give you an idea of how different systems work, if you look at the average person stays with their health plan for 2 years. Okay, that I'm not kidding you. That's the average length of time a person's with a particular health insurer. With Kaiser, the average person stays with Kaiser for 10 years. Okay, Kaiser has one of the best preventative health care plans of any health insurer. Why? Because they know that their patients are with them for 10 years, and if they're going to become profitable as an insurer, they have to keep them healthy. So your mentality completely changes when you become nonprofit, and your mission is to take care of patients rather than take care of shareholders. I mean, it's just a whole, I mean, think about it. I mean, it truly is not rocket science.
Commissioner Greenough?
Just one point. You brought up how important it is that we know the flow of money to our legislators and where it comes from. And there's a real good website, it's called opensecrets.org, and they accumulate all this data of who contributes to whose organization, and it's a good idea to keep tabs on that and just see where, all the way from presidential candidates to our local California people.
I know locally we've made a huge push with our elected officials about taking tobacco money, and the only person that represents our county that takes tobacco money right now is Kevin McCarthy. And we have been pounding on his organization saying, you know, you guys are not with our county. And but I'm sure it's on that website.
Commissioner Warren?
Yeah, I have a question that was brought up here a few years back about people cycling through the emergency rooms when there's a problem with substance abuse, with overdoses and detoxification, and is this an issue that the emergency room physicians are still finding?
I'm probably not expert enough to answer that. I think that would be something that Dr. Christensen or Dr. Hale on our board would be able to answer. I'll get an answer for you.
Okay. Thank you.
I'll get an answer to you.
Commissioner Shimousis? All right, closing comment, your comment about Kaiser. Actually, the ideology of Kaiser sort of turned the whole system on its end because their initial organization was aimed toward preventative as opposed to acute care. And when you start out with that kind of philosophy, it progresses toward what it is today. Initially, they came into a lot of pressure to go that route, and now they're enjoying the limelight as a kind of a model organization.
Right.
So,
you know, the other thing I think that people aren't aware of is that most hospitals in our country started as nonprofit, community-based hospitals, and they were started by the business community. And they were started by the business community because the business community needs a healthy workforce. And, you know, I think all too often, even our local chamber, as much as I pound on them, they don't seem to understand how important healthcare is in your community, because if employers don't have healthy employees, they have no businesses to run. So you're right. It started in the cement trenches down in L.A.
I can't thank you enough for coming, Dr. Okay. Vernacki. You've reminded us where we've come from, where we've been, and where we need to go.
Thank you, and thank you for having me, and I once sat on your side there, too, so I know what it's like.
Okay, and another former health commissioner is up next, Kathleen Carley. Welcome.
I served with Pam on the health commission 10 years ago. And I worked with Penny at Mission Medical, and then I went to work with Ed at Marion Medical Center. So it's a very small healthcare community. Thank you for having me here today. I'm here today. I've decided in my old age to become a bureaucrat. And I'm here. I'm the program manager for the Health Systems Division in the County Health Agency. Our division is called Health Systems because we manage a couple of small programs. They're pass-through programs that we pay for unreimbursed care in the emergency room. But our main program is a county medical services program. And let me see if I got a few slides. It skipped, but that's okay. You've got the first page. And basically, it just says the first page just gives our mission statement. We determine eligibility and provide utilization review and accounting services to ensure proper access to health care for the medically indigent adult. We serve the patient that is not eligible for Medi-Cal. And ours is a relatively small program when you look at numbers of Medi-Cal. They said Medi-Cal has 25,000 Medi-Cal lives, I believe, in San Luis Obispo County. We serve on any given time 600 to 800 people per month. Our program was established in 1983 to address Welfare and Institutions Code 17,000, which gave the duty of providing health care for indigent adults to the counties. We serve indigent adults between 21 and 64 who do not qualify for other government-funded programs. They cannot be permanently disabled or pregnant because then they would be eligible for Medi-Cal. They must be a San Luis Obispo County resident for at least 15 days with the intent to reside. What we're trying to do there is to keep somebody passing through that happens to end up in the emergency room and wants us to pay their bill for them, but then tends to go to the next place. So we're looking for residents that we would provide care for. They need to be a U.S. citizen or have a permanent resident status. They must have a medical need. Medi-Cal is an insurance program. You have it just in case something goes wrong. The County Medical Services Program is for people that have a medical need. You don't just get it just in case something goes wrong. You get it in response to a symptom or in response to ending up in the emergency room. Yes, sir? Of course.
This would not include, as you've just stated, people that don't have a green card. Illegal aliens would not be served by this program.
That's right.
I often hear people complaining that we're doing all kinds of favors for illegal aliens. So this doesn't, but is there some other way that they access health care?
And I'll address them. First of all, you do have people come in our office all the time and complain about these people that are getting all of these services. People that are undocumented, I'm a healthcare professional. I've worked in the healthcare field for 20 years. In my personal opinion, we all have a right to healthcare. But each county can set the decision whether or not they cover undocumented people. Most counties in the state of California do not cover undocumented people, and it's simply a budget decision. The county of Monterey, for example, was covering undocumented, and in 2002 they had to stop doing it simply because they just did not have enough money to uphold their mission. They just couldn't do it anymore. Fresno County, from my understanding, still does cover undocumented. But it all depends on when the money runs out. In our county is very wise because we do have a contract with Community Health Centers of the Central Coast. And Community Health Centers are the safety net in our county. So people who are not documented in our county cannot be served by the County Medical Services Program. However, we have people come to our office and get a letter saying that they're denied access to our program because they're undocumented. And with that letter, they can take it to community health centers, and at community health centers, they're put on a sliding fee scale. And so their primary care, their pharmacy care is taken care of. Where people run into trouble is when they need surgeries. And we're very fortunate to have some fine nonprofit hospitals in our community that will work with undocumented people. They have charity care programs. Even our for-profit hospitals have patient assistance programs that they can help patients. But the answer to your question is they have to be documented to be in our program, to be an official participant in our program. And it is pretty frustrating when you hear people complaining about these people getting everything. And it's usually the people that are trying to get away with something that are the ones complaining about somebody else. So it's kind of interesting sometimes. Okay. Their income must be less than 250% of the federal poverty level, and they have to have low assets. I do have a slide a little further on that I can show you so you get an idea what income and assets are for our program. Let's see if I turn this on. There we go. If a veteran applies to our program, we will refer them to the VA if they're eligible. One of the things we've learned from the VA is they have to have accessed VA health care within the past 24 months to be eligible for VA benefits. It also, you know, when they served in the Air Force or Army, you know, makes a difference. But basically, the basic rule is they had to have accessed care in the past 24 months. So if a vet comes into us and they haven't accessed care in the past 24 months, we will put them on our program for a short period of time. We will take care of their immediate needs. We'll send them over to the VA, get them hooked up with the VA system, and then from that point forward, they would be with the VA health care. But we'll help them initially. The length of eligibility for our program is from 1 to 6 months, and that varies a lot depending on work condition and medical need. What happens is if somebody was working and they come to our program but they're not going to be working, you know, they hurt themselves, they're going to be off work, we put them on for a month. And the reason we do it is because they have everybody on our program has that is working, that has an income, has potentially a share of cost. So we want their share of cost to be realistic. So we'll put them on our program for 1 month, and then at the end of that month, adjust their share of cost based on their lowered income for the previous 30 days, because we use it their past 30-day income to determine what their share of cost would be. And then they can go all the way up to 6 months. A lot of our mental health clients we put on for 6 months because we want them to have access to their medications. It's extremely important. And if they have to keep signing up and coming back in doing paperwork, they tend to be non-compliant, and then they don't get their medication, and that's a community problem for all of us. We contract with community health centers to provide all of our primary medical care, pharmacy, and lab services for CMSP patients. They act as the gatekeepers. They're your primary care physicians, and they are the physicians that refer patients to specialty care. We have a utilization department, some nurses in our department. So a primary care doctor at community health centers would say, for example, this patient needs to see a urologist. So they would call our utilization nurses. They would ask for a referral to a urologist. Either the community health centers will find a urologist, or we will, and we'll hook the patient up with the urologist and get them the specialty care that they need. You know, SenCal was saying they pay about 25% higher than Medi-Cal. We actually pay Medicare rates, which is about 25% higher than that. And we actually turn our claims around in about 14 days if, you know, they've been authorized and everything. So, you know, we don't pay a lot of money, but we have a fairly good relationship with the physicians that we work with in the community, and they are willing to see our patients. And so that's a good thing. After receiving unexpected medical care, for example, somebody ends up in the emergency room, they are not on our program, they have 7 days to sign up for our program. All of the emergency departments are trained to send people to us because they want to be paid, you know? So they do a very good job of telling people you need to get into CMSP within 7 days. We have brochures in all of our emergency departments. We work well with all of the emergency departments. And there's big signs that we made this year that are posted in all the ERs that say, you know, you may have a way to pay for this bill, and they direct people to us. It usually works. You know, there are some people that, you know, there's always some people that it doesn't, they say they never heard. And when that happens, again, we tell people to come to us. I give them a denial letter. And if they have a denial letter from us saying that they came too late to be apply to our program, then they take that back to Arroyo Grande or French or Sierra Vista, and they talk to the billing people there, and then they ask for a patient assistance application. And then if they follow through with the hospital can help them with your emergency room bills. So we have a good relationship. You know, this is a lot of information for a slide, but I wanted you to see the kind of verifications that we ask of people. So people come in, they say, I want to be on your program, and so we try and verify the statements that they make. We ask for some kind of government ID, usually a driver's license, but it can be an ID card, it can be a birth certificate, it can be a passport, some people have passports. We ask for a Social Security card, but if we can verify their Social Security number in, we have access to state databases, and if we can verify their Social Security number in our databases, we don't make them go get a card. That means that they've talked to somebody in government somewhere and shown their card to them, and as long as we can verify that, we don't make them, because a lot of people do not have their Social Security cards. A permanent resident card, we ask for copies of recent savings and checking account statements to verify that they, you know, don't have a whole bunch of money in their account. You'd be amazed, sometimes people will come in and they'll have like $15,000 in their checking account, and I think, I wish I had $15,000 in my checking account. But most people are very honest. We ask for paycheck stubs, last year's tax return. If they're paying child support, we ask for a proof of child support, because we can use that, subtract that, as long as it's government ordered by a court somewhere, we can subtract that from their share of cost obligation and give them credit for it. And if they're self-employed, a lot of our people are self-employed, we ask for 3 months of business records, and it's very informal. You know, we have one man that we always joke about. He's a guy that collects cans, and he turns cans in, and he will bring us 3 months of records. You know, this day I turned in $3.21, or this day, you know, and he's very honest, and most people are very honest. We give people 21 days to turn in the verifications to us. Which is, you know, we used to give 5 days and then give an extension, and our phones were going crazy. Then they'd want another extension, and so we finally just said, Medi-Cal does 21 days, we do 21 days, and it's usually sufficient for everyone. One of the misconceptions is people do not need a denial letter from Medi-Cal to apply for our program. Sometimes, you know, we all know what gas is like nowadays. We all know you send these people all over the county to apply for all these programs, wait in line. If the person is not under 21 or over 65, if the person is not a single parent, or if the person is not permanently disabled, we assume they're not eligible for Medi-Cal, because those are the big questions you would ask for Medi-Cal eligibility, and we would just not make them go there. Now, if they're a single parent, or there appears to be an absent parent in the home, then we want Medi-Cal to make a determination. So we would send them to Department of Social Services. But we try and limit the amount that we're sending these people all over the county. We try and serve them to the best of our ability when we've got them in our office. We only have one office. We have a small staff. There's, I think, 10.75 people in our department, you know. And so we only have one location. We're located in the old General Hospital, and which is very nice for me, because I understand for 25 years they were in the trailers behind the hospital, and I only had to be in those trailers for a few months, and so it was very nice for me to be inside the building, although some of our staff used to work in the hospital, and it's kind of bittersweet for them. Our hours are 8:30 to 4. We did a survey recently, and we asked people, are our hours okay? And surprisingly, over 80% said that they were, because many of our people do not work. You know, some of them do, but many of them don't, or they, you know, have part-time jobs, and they're able to get in during the time that we're open. And there is a number to call if you have more questions. Now, my next slide is to just show you, to give you an idea what 250% of federal poverty level is and what the property limitations. So a single person, in order to qualify for our program, and that's gross income, cannot make over $2,167 per month. Property limitations are $2,000. That means they can have $2,000 in the bank. We have a lot of people that come in and they'll have like five cars. Now, usually, you know, it's a 1962 something and a, you know, 1971 something, or they might have a motorcycle, you know. And so that property could either be cash in the bank or it could be their property. We have some people that come in that own several properties, you know, and if the If the equity exceeds $2,000, it doesn't mean they can't be on our program, but they would have to spend down their excess property till they reach that $2,000 limit. So let's say somebody had $2,500 in the bank, but they met our income guideline. They would have to spend $500 of that money in the bank on their medical care before they could qualify for our program. And we're pretty specific, they would have to be on medical care. They can't go have a vacation or go down to Chumash Casino and spend $500, you know. But they could spend $500 on their medical care, and that would be any time in the previous 90 days, or they can encumber $500. So let's say they were going to have a surgery, and they were going to go in the hospital, and the hospital bill was going to be, I don't know how many thousand dollars. They could go to the hospital, make a deal, I'm going to pay you $500 of this, and then CMSP will pay the rest, and as long as the hospital was willing to accept the payment of that, you know, whatever payment plan the person worked out, that would be a way they could spend down their excess property. Okay? And caseload, factors affecting caseload. Well, I mean, as you all can probably guess, economy, number one thing up there. You know, when times are bad, we generally get more people walking in the door. We typically have between 600 and 800 people on CMSP per month, and it fluctuates. We've had a lot more, you know, and interestingly, I was going to bring a graph for you, but I actually saw our numbers recently were down as far as people signed up. But we have a lot more people walking in the door. And so, you know, since I was doing this at 10 o'clock this morning, I can't give you a real good answer as to why that's happening. Although I do think a lot of the people that are coming in are permanently disabled and they're applying for Medi-Cal and SSI. So we have a lot of people that come into our office. When someone is Medi-Cal or SSI pending, we don't put them on our program. We give them what's called a CMSP backup letter. In other words, we give them a letter that's going to guarantee their care at community health centers until this determination is made of their disability status. And just so you know, it could take up to 2 years for Medi-Cal or SSI to determine if someone is disabled. And that's extremely difficult for somebody while they're waiting. You know, I grew up in a very Catholic family, and it kind of reminds me of somebody being in purgatory, right? Because you're not really in heaven, but you're not really in the other place either, you know? And that's where a lot of these people that are Medi-Cal and SSI pending, that's where they're at. They're waiting for a determination. It can take a very long time. But we've had a lot of people come in recently that are trying that. We also have an aggressive case management program. Our nurses, we only have 1.5 of them, but they do an amazing job with our clients. And they work with them very closely while they're waiting to get Medi-Cal approved. They also found out this year, you know, they had a great discovery because they found out that if someone needs urgent medical care and the care cannot be provided in their county of residence, you can get an expedited Medi-Cal application. And in the past, CMSP was paying for all these patients, sending them to Stanford. We had one in 05-06. It was like $250,000 that we paid. We actually got reimbursed this year for most of that money, but we were out that money for several years. And because of, as Dr. Vinakia said, because of the lack of some specialists in our area, there's people that need things that they cannot get in this county. And so our nurses have found that if you have these critically ill patients, they can get them on an expedited Medi-Cal application, and they can be approved sometimes within a week. We've also found some cancer patients that can actually get the care here, but some of our oncologists will not see them without a payer source because oncology is very expensive. And so you can't blame the doctors. I mean, you know, they can't pay thousands and thousands of dollars. And so we've been able to get some cancer patients expedited Medi-Cal approval and on Medi-Cal within a week. So that saves our caseload, but it also benefits the patient and benefits the community at large. We've also found, you know, Sue asked earlier about substance-dependent individuals. You know, we have, because we manage these emergency funds that, you know, care for unreimbursed care in the emergency room, and we also see these emergency bills, claims, come across our desk all the time. A lot of substance abuse is occurring in the emergency rooms, and I think Dr. Hale and Dr. Christensen would back you up on that. But it used to be that when you were substance dependent, you almost got a free ride to Medi-Cal, and that is no longer the case. Now, if you're substance dependent, it doesn't matter how long you've been substance dependent, you can't get Medi-Cal unless you prove that you're permanently disabled. So you're in that year to 2 years. It's no longer a get-out-of-jail-free card, you know. It's a lot of work. And you're dealing with people that have a lot of issues that tend to be non-compliant anyway, and the paperwork sometimes just overwhelms them, you know. So they'll apply, and then they'll get, you know, 2 or 3 months into the program, and then they drop out, and they come to our office, and then they apply again, and they'll lose their Social Security card. I mean, it's this endless cycle. But because they can't get automatic Medi-Cal, they tend to stay on our caseload longer. The other thing that's reduced our caseload is that Community Health Centers has a Healthcare for the Homeless program. I don't know if you've heard about it, but it's funded by federal grants. So if somebody comes into our office and all they need, they're homeless, and all they need is primary care and pharmacy, we do not put them on our program. We have a good relationship with Community Health Centers. We call their office. We enroll them in the homeless program. It's better for the person because they don't have to fill out any papers. They're on it automatically for a year. And we send them over. Now, they tend to come back, you know, a month later, and they say, I don't know what program I'm on. And so then we go through the thing again, and we send them back. But it is a wonderful program, and it's funded by federal dollars, and Community Health Centers deserves a lot of credit for having that program. And then the last thing that affects our caseload is HIV and cancer patients are remaining eligible for CMSP longer due to medical treatment advances. You know, it used to be, you know, we all know HIV was a death sentence, right? And look how long Magic Johnson has lived. I mean, beyond, you know, what anyone thought, I think, when he made his announcement. And so in cancer patients, the same thing. A lot of medical advances. And so simply because you have HIV or you have cancer does not mean you're going to get Medi-Cal. You know, if you're able to work, then they're going to expect you to work and they're not going to label you permanently disabled. And so they're staying on our caseload longer. So I think that's my last slide. I tried to make it short and succinct. Do you guys have any questions for me?
Carl Odell.
Yes, so you have contracts with the hospitals too? Or?
Yes, yeah, we do.
And what is your total budget?
Our total budget is $3.5 million approximately. However, that's not a completely accurate budget because there's a separate fund in the county that pays for the contract with Community Health Centers. That does not come out of our budget.
Okay.
And that's a little over $5 million. And so, correct, Jeff?
It used to be a little over now.
A little under, that's right. So, about $5 million. And so that's paying Community Health Centers. And the CMSP patients are a relatively small percentage of Community Health Center total visits.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, the care that's being provided to our patients is in that budget as well. We just can't break it out. But within our CMSP program, it's about $3.5 million.
Thank you.
Commissioner Garina?
A little bit high.
Hi,
a little further along on the volume part. How many patients, how many contacts or patients do you typically see in a year? What is a year's volume of patients? And then of that, your budget is 3.5. Is that what you spend typically per year, and has that been growing or decreasing over the last few years?
Okay. We, on an average day, we have about 40 people walk in our office, okay? That's an average day. In a given month, we have 600 to 800 people. Some people come in, and I hate to be vague when I say this, but a lot of people come in, they start the form, and you never see them again, you know? I would bet a good 20 to 25% of people start the process, and then you never see them again. Of that 600 to 800 people that we have every month, a lot of them are repeat customers. You got a lot of people with chronic diseases. You know, we have a lot of HIV patients. We have a lot of substance abuse patients that, you know, have pancreatitis and have a lot of conditions, diabetes, hypertension. You know, individual encounters, I don't have that information, okay? Our budget, and Jeff will tell you he's very proud of us, our budget has actually decreased this year, okay? And it's decreased because of a couple of reasons. One, because we found that clause in Medi-Cal, so we're not paying these big out-of-county costs anymore like we used to. And I think the second thing is that we're managing our money better. You know, we're very efficient at what we do, and we're trying to work smarter. So our budget has actually decreased this year. This year, we normally get about $500,000 in general fund support from the county. It's actually $522,000, and we were able to give the county back that money this year. And we were also able to give it back, well, give it back last year and also this budget year as well. So we've saved the county just in working efficient and doing what we do better about $1 million in the past 2 years.
If I can continue, you spoke about your caseload has increased because of the substance abuse that's out there. Now, are these medical conditions that arise from substance abuse, or do you actually help with some substance abuse recovery programs?
We don't.
Okay.
We don't pay for substance abuse. We refer them to drug and alcohol services. We only take care of the medical part. And as a result, you know, it's often difficult because they don't put down, you know, when we're looking at tracking how many substance abuse patients, it's not their first diagnosis. I mean, it's coming down three or four, and so it often doesn't show up on our reports. You know, we've been trying to do a QA look at our patients every month. We're not finding substance abuse at all, and our nurses go, wait a minute here. We know it's substance abuse because it's three or four down the and it's usually only the first two that show up. But we're only dealing with the medical aspect of it. Okay.
Commissioner O'Dell?
You said that the general fund is only $520,000?
Our general fund contribution was $522,000. Not for the entire county, just for our department.
Yeah, but you have an overall budget of 3.5 million.
3.5. That was
where does the rest of the revenue come from?
From realignment dollars.
Oh, yeah. Funny money.
Are there any more questions or comments?
Well, thank you all very much. It was very
pleasant. Our pleasure, Kathleen.
You know, I'll listen to my boss and then I'm going to take off.
Mr. Hamm, you have the spotlight.
Good evening. Thank you very much. Isn't she great? We are so lucky to have you. She's doing such a great job. The money didn't really go back to the county, but it did. It was a very, very good thing, obviously, and it helped the general fund contribution to the health agency. It kept it from being even higher than it would have been otherwise. So, we're the kind of stuff we're looking for within the health agency everywhere, you know, everywhere we can. I can actually get my email on this teeny tiny little screen, so I was just reading at the beginning of the meeting the most recent budget update from the CHEAC staff who send out budget updates and legislative updates to health execs in all the counties. And, you know, day 42 just ended. The bottom line from the message that I just received is that they don't think they're any closer to real resolution of the problem in Sacramento. They are not.
Oh, man.
They don't appear to be any closer. A lot of weird stuff is going on, and it probably will continue to be quite strange in terms of the politics and the, you know, the threats and people suing one another and the state controllers' conflict with the governor about the executive order and legislative leadership threatening to file lawsuits for, you know, it's just a circus. For us, it means that we continue to sit and worry about how the final resolution, which, I mean, has to happen sooner or later, about how it's going to affect the county generally and obviously more specifically the health agency. If you've been reading about any of the aspects of the state budget deliberations that you've read about the Prop 1A exemption, I think it was 04 or something like that the voters in California passed Proposition 1A. It was designed to preclude the state from basically stealing local revenues from cities and counties as a way to help balance their budget problem. but they allowed themselves in the way that it was drafted. They could actually still transfer up to a certain percent, I think it's 5% or something like that, total property tax revenues from counties and local jurisdictions to the state, but they had to repay it in 3 years. And they couldn't do it again until they had repaid the first loan that they took out from us. That could mean, I think I read David Edge quoted in the paper as something about $6 or $7 million of our property tax revenues just for the county, depending on the specifics of the transfer. I think I've reported to you that we believe just in the health agency we're about $500,000. We were about $500,000 optimistic in our Medi-Cal reimbursement revenues for mental health services. The legislature rejected the governor's proposal to further reduce Medi-Cal rates for mental health services, but they did not object to his proposal to leave them level from last year to this year. And in our budget that we submitted back in February, we assumed the traditional increase, I think, of reasonable 3% or something like that, but it's about $500,000 that we're pretty sure we're not going to get. I think that's probably the best case outcome for us in terms of the health agency budget is being the $500,000 in the hole. It could be much worse than that, so everybody's kind of anxiously waiting to see what happens. Flip side is Dr. Baylor shared a memo with me today. She was very happy. She came in, she threw it on my desk. We just got another $600,000 from MHSA's. It's intended to be for technology improvements, infrastructure. So it's a very strange thing to be broker than broke and then having all this Prop 63 money coming our way for new services and new things. And so it's kind of a strange thing. Any questions about that topic? I had just a couple things I want to touch on briefly as a part of my report this month. Tobacco retail licensing ordinance that we actually, I think, sought your opinion on maybe a year and a half or 2 years ago initially. We went to the Board of Supervisors probably a year ago and got their conceptual approval, and then we ran into staffing shortages in tobacco control and throughout the agency, and it sort of sat on the back burner. It wasn't even on the back burner. It was off the stovetop entirely. Susan Hughes deserves a tremendous amount of credit for finally finding a way to get that done. We took it to the board last Tuesday on consent to introduce the ordinance. The board tweaked it a little bit, and we're bringing it back tomorrow morning as a consent item to introduce it in. Hopefully they'll set it for a public hearing on August 26th. In a nutshell, it strengthens local law enforcement's ability to enforce the existing laws that preclude tobacco retailers from selling tobacco products and paraphernalia to minors. The current penal code provisions only allow fines to be levied against the individual clerks that are, if they are ever caught, violating the existing prohibition from selling to minors. This will place an incentive on the actual owners of the retail establishment by the consequences of suspending their license and precluding them from selling tobacco products. So it also provides a revenue source through a fee that would be established on businesses who would apply for and be interested in obtaining the license that would fund our ongoing compliance and education, and we work with tobacco retailers on education and et cetera. Three other cities already have an ordinance in place, and in those jurisdictions, part of the fee also goes to the police department to help offset the cost of their involvement in the compliance checks. The sheriff wasn't interested in contributing to the amount of the fee, which I think to his credit was a very good thing. The sheriff's office will be the law enforcement agency of jurisdiction, of course, because we're talking about retailers in the unincorporated area. So ordinance would require, I think it's three, it might be four, but three compliance checks for every one of those licensees per year. So a little sting operation. You get minors and you train them on how to go in and, you know, attempt to buy tobacco products, and cops are waiting outside. So that'll be on tomorrow's consent agenda, and then, like I said, set for the end of the month, August 26th, for a hearing. I thought your question, Ed, to Dr. Bernanke about the trauma system plan was a very interesting question. I couldn't wait to hear his answer. And then he kind of went like this, I thought. yes, you have to have a plan that designs a system that ultimately involves presumably one or more hospitals applying for designation as a trauma center, either as a level two or a level three. But I thought he kind of dismissed the complications associated with the first step there. The plan development process has generated a lot of controversy amongst not only emergency department physicians, but hospital executives, and there's been quite a bit of fur flying on that topic. And it falls in our lap, basically. The EMS agency is a function of the health agency. We happen to contract with SLO EMSA Inc. for the staff support and for their board of directors to serve as the Emergency Medical Care Committee, but it's clearly a county responsibility. The Board of Supervisors approved the existing trauma system plan in 04, and any modifications to the plan, and that's what we're talking about, would have to be recommended to the board, approved by the board before they'd be submitted to the plan would be submitted to the state EMS authority for its review and approval. I agree with him completely about we all have the same vision, I think, of the best possible system. There's some controversy and some disagreement about the number of patients that would qualify as trauma patients. You know, he gave a couple examples where you would, you know, the first responders in the field, the emergency medical responders, would say, oh yeah, this patient meets the criteria that's been developed as a part of the plan, take them directly to the hospital that has the trauma center designation. The numbers that our consultant came up with were there were only about 150 cases a year in out of 100,000, you know, including the self, you know, the walk-ins that would meet that criteria. And I've heard lots of folks say we think that for, you know, for neurotrauma, most of those patients are already ending up at Sierra Vista anyway. They might go to the closest hospital, whether it's Rio Grande or French or Twin, and then be assessed and transferred. Some folks in the emergency medical community think the number is much higher. And the anxiety, the level of anxiety that has been demonstrated by some of the folks who have written letters and it was quite surprising.
I think that's my fear is you hate to see more polarization out there of what we've already got, and we don't want to, just because somebody wants to empire build, we don't want to make our situation worse in this county.
Right. Well, easy for me to say. I think it's going to be a little bit more difficult to actually deliver, but it's been very easy for me to share with Mr. Iftinick, Ms. Markwith, Drs. Christensen and Hale, all the folks who have written letters, that I'm going to be standing here or there or sitting up there with a recommendation to the Board of Supervisors, and I'm going to have to be very sure that with all the stakeholders in the room ready to pounce on any misrepresentations, we're going to have to be very sure that any changes that we would advise as a part of our plan revision are going to be an improvement to the system overall, not an improvement here and you know, degradation here and here. It has to be something that the net benefit is an improvement to the system. And if it takes us months, you know, the timeline is not firm. We're working with the EMS agency staff on the development of the project plan for updating. There is a trauma system plan subcommittee. They have regular meetings. Hospitals and ER groups and, you know, physician groups are all represented. The medical association is represented. So there's a lot of work that has to be done, and we have to find a way to get to the truth. And we're going to have to do that as a part of the plan process. So the first step is, I think, going to be the most difficult. So any other questions about trauma system planning? Yes.
Yes, I have one. Is there a number, some sort of criterion that determines whether or not an emergency trauma system makes sense, and at what level, what capacity? I mean, how does that kind of figure into the whole process of planning?
I think volume does matter. The ratio between demand for care and the number of facilities does matter. Clearly, level one trauma centers, which are the highest level of response capability or medical capability, only exist in major metropolitan areas where you have tremendous volume because the requirements are so intense. That's not the right word, but they're so, yes, costly. Thank you. In 03, leading up to the development of our first plan, the folks who were working on the plan said to the hospital folks, so what do y'all think? You know, and three of them said, well, we think we'd like to be level three trauma centers. And so we wrote a plan that said, we think the county should have three level three trauma centers. The plan kind of got shelved, and then the executive director of the EMS agency left a year and a half ago. There was some question about whether the county should continue to contract with a local nonprofit that existed solely to contract with the county to be the EMS agency, or whether we should bring it in-house and do what most counties, all other counties like us, do, which is to have a LEMSA, a local emergency medical services agency, embedded in its public health department, which is the more traditional model. In this room, folks who have been named this evening stood up and said it should stay the way it is. And the Board of Supervisors said, okay, well, that's what we'll do. We'll leave it the way it is. And we renewed a contract, and we increased the amount that we pay them from $100,000 to $400,000 a year, recognizing how much work there really is to do and how much they had not been doing. They hired a new executive director, Charlotte Alexander. They have now hired three additional staff people, so they're fully staffed. Plus, they have a part-time medical director in ER, Dr. Renee. And so after a couple months, Charlotte said, what's with this trauma system plan? It seems like we didn't really do a very good job on it. Dated 04, you know, says we're going to have three level three trauma centers. Hospitals, what do you all think? Well, Sierra Vista said, well, we think we could be a level two now. And that's sort of what started really started rocking the boat. I mean, and to your question, we hired a consultant to hopefully bring in an expert objective perspective and opinion, and she was the principal author, but she had a partner. They produced a report, and the report concluded that we have got to the point where we're of the size and we have the volume that, and maybe the hospitals, in terms of the way their systems have evolved, have gotten to the point where we're close to maybe one of the hospitals could actually meet the requirements for a level two trauma center without having to invest a whole lot more, or without having to lure limited resources in our community away from the other hospitals in a way that would be detrimental to their specialty call panel coverage and that kind of stuff. And so she, Diane Akers, was the consultant. She concluded that, yeah, we think this county is at that point in time of its evolution and growth and size and stuff where maybe that would be a better system. But be careful about these other consequences. And that's basically what she concluded. So we were moving in the direction of finding answers, or we are still in the process of trying to get answers to the questions about the things that are of concern to hospital execs and emergency department physicians and other folks who care about that stuff. So it's on the top of my list, or close to the top. One other thing, animal services have been in the paper. Those of you who have been around a while will remember when Animal Services was a division of the Public Health Department of the County Health Agency. It's an option that will be considered, I think, at the point in time when the county gets serious about the alternatives. A freestanding department is an alternative. We're talking about things like contracting with Woods for components of the service, leaving the field enforcement component in law enforcement. So just thought I'd touch on that. The administrative office has been working with stakeholders and interested parties for months now. They did get the Humane Society in to take a look at the existing arrangements and made some recommendations about how things could evolve. We used to have an Animal Services Advisory Committee. So I think that's one of the things that folks are suggesting might be an improvement to the way the county handles the delivery of animal control services, is by having a dedicated advisory body, you know, specifically focused on that. So there's no reason to believe any particular outcome in that analysis, but I thought since it's sort of in the paper and you might be hearing rumors about it or whatever, that I would be upfront with you about it.
I have a question. I have been following it in the paper, and one of the things that was brought up is that some of the prisoners from the Honor Farm were coming over there to work with them.
Right.
And I know some of the volunteers are upset about that. Was there training for those prisoners before they went over there to do this volunteer job? Because I noticed that's one of the things that's been brought up that was missing for the community volunteers was a training program and protocol. If it wasn't there for them, was it there for the prisoners? And
yeah, the short answer is I don't know.
Okay. Well, it seems to me that they ought to get another chance and have that opportunity to have the same training.
Yeah. I'd be perfectly happy with any conclusion that allowed animal services to exist outside of the health agency, frankly. but if my boss tells me that it's going to the health agency, I'm going to say we'll do the best possible job we can. And I did notice with regard to the use of trustees in the Honor Farm that the sheriff's office personnel who responded, I forget the person who was the spokesperson in the article, said, well, you know, they're free. So they should be trained. And trustees are used for lots of things. We use them to move furniture around and stuff. Yeah, with adequate training, I don't know why they wouldn't provide a very cost-effective component of the workforce in the shelter operation, the shelter component of the operation. So,
And it's actually been used, I believe, in Texas as part of a rehab
program.
So we'd be ahead of the game.
Yeah. Well, if it ended up in the health agency, I sure hope the sheriff would allow us to continue to use trustees. We'll train them because they're a lot more cost-effective than regular paid staff. Those were the items I wanted to cover. Anything that you guys, any issues that you've been wondering about that I could help you with?
I'm concerned about the California Valley complaint, Jeff. It sounds like Ms. Nolan's been kind of tossed hither and yon, and I don't know if maybe we should bring Art Trinidad in or put that on our agenda for November when we're going to talk about land use and buffer zones and, you know, see if maybe we can't get some input in November, but I would hate to think of other people dying in California Valley if there was any nexus.
Yeah, we certainly within your discretion to agendize whatever you'd like. But just for your information, the note I had made to myself when I heard her public comment was to, starting tomorrow, gather up some information from folks that she has indicated that she's been in contact with. And I'd be happy to write up a little summary of what I find out and just send it. I'll have Jean send it to you guys just for your information. And then that'll help you decide whether you want to pursue it further in some future meeting or not.
That would be great. And then we could make the decision maybe at the next meeting.
I have a question, and it came in on our little public health bulletin that we get, and I do read it.
I haven't read
it yet. Well, yeah. Hepatitis C, chronic, for January through April, it was about 31 to 40 cases per month. May, it jumped to 145. June, it jumped to 255, and which gave us a total for 2008. Or that's, I guess, for this year. Then the total for 2008 is 550, where our total for 2007 was 366.
Did it say why?
No. No, I just got numbers.
What kind of an article is that?
I know. I want to know why, and I want to know, is there a chance that we're, again, like we were doing with some of the other figures before, are we including the incarcerated populations?
I'll ask Dr. McMillan to work with Ann and see what we can come up with in response to that question.
Okay, thank you.
I reminded me I did want to give you an update on Dr. Bornstein's arrival. She's going to start September 2nd. That's the current plan. So we're creeping up on it. We got her a contract. She signed it. It hasn't shown up on my desk yet. So I can't put her contract on the board's agenda. It'll probably be on the agenda for the 26th. So, but she's sold her. They've sold her house. She's leasing just down the street from the public health department, and she's excited about starting to work for us. So I'm very excited about that too. I know Jean is too. Although Dr. McMillan has been excellent and such a pleasure to work with. He's really saved us. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Okay, chair update. Chair's not here. The vice chair has no update. I'll start to my right, Ed, or no. Commissioner Green.
No report.
Commissioner Warren?
Yes, the Drug and Alcohol Advisory Board had Sheriff Reed, he was from the Sheriff's Department, and he was talking about the reentry facility and kind of what that would look like and the kinds of programs and things that could be offered out there. And he said that by September 18th, they'll have an idea. Seven counties got chosen and we're eight on the list, but there were a couple of counties that might not be able to meet the requirements of it. So technically, we hope we're still in the running. It sounds like a very effective program if we're able to go there.
Commissioner O'Dell?
No report.
Commissioner Shimousis?
I was unfortunately unable to attend the Adult Services Policy Council meeting. However, I will report on the meeting both for July and August at next month's Health Commission meeting.
Commissioner Williams.
I attended the CSN meeting, and they are in the process of setting goals and priorities. For advocacy, they will be doing the homeless, gang activities, teen programs, and mental illness. For action, they have gone to substance abuse and truancy dropout rate. I will not be able to attend, but I will get emails because that happens to be the same time when the RAC meets, and I am an observer to RAC, so I'll report on whatever I get by email.
Commissioner Arnold?
Thank you. It was my pleasure to meet with the HIV Care Consortium, a very nice group of people who are doing important work. Mainly, it's the AIDS support network that's under that umbrella, but also the syringe exchange program is under them. So it's prevention and care on HIV. They reported they have 35 new clients for the AIDS Support Network, so they came up with a total of 140 people in the program. Unfortunately, I will not be able to, there's a conflict because of the change of our meeting time for October. I won't be able to go to the next one, but I will certainly get the minutes and consult with Marsha Bollinger and give you a report on that at the November meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Okay, Legislative Committee.
We have not met.
Community Ed, we have not met. Budget?
The budget's separate, too. The budget has been combined, you know.
With
the legislative.
Okay. Well, then nobody's met. Has nominating met?
Yeah, well, it says possible action. And I do have an hour of discussion. We have two vacancies, and we'll be meeting the nominating committee before the next meeting and report to the Health Commission about these two vacancies.
Thank you. Anything for prospective future items? I'm not sure what we're doing next month. Do you know, Jean?
Child abuse prevention.
You're right.
Lisa Frazier's, I've already talked with Lisa, and she's going to do a presentation on the various programs that they're doing. And I'm working on something for the Recovery Month also.
Good.
I was just curious, too, because maybe, I don't know if Dr. Hale or any of them might be here, but we might somehow get a report from the emergency room physicians as to what trends they might be seeing in substance abuse. So I'll check with Jean on that and see if maybe we can at least get something.
Okay. And that would segue nicely into October for domestic violence,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, because it all has a connection.
It's all connected. So.
Thanks. And then I think Jeff Hamm will report back as far as California Valley and the folks out there. And we're about 8 minutes short of our quitting time, but I'll entertain a motion to adjourn the meeting.
So moved.
All in favor?
Aye.
We're done.